So this is our first day of this four-day retreat here in Tampa at the Franciscan Center. And during these 4 days, we are going to be looking deeply into a part of this text that is referred to as the mind trainings. Can everybody hear me? If you can't hear me at some point, please let me know that in some way. So during the course of this retreat, we will be looking into these mind trainings. We will be reflecting on them. And when I say reflecting, I mean deeply looking into them so we really understand them, not just here, but in our true heart mind. When we are not doing that, we should be practicing our regular practice of mindfulness. Again, as we said yesterday, last night, mindfulness implies that the mind is aware of what it is doing. If the mind is not aware of what it's doing, it is distracted. Okay, so let's keep it very simple. You can be distracted in many, 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 many ways. But the bottom line is you're distracted. So the thing that is distracting you is not important. It is the fact that you have left mindfulness. You are no longer, your awareness is not present to what is experiencing in front of you and has gone off into some sort of mental fabrication. Mental fabrications are things that your mind is fabricating. Whether it's a good fabrication, a bad fabrication, a meaningful fabrication, a meaningless fabrication, and on and on and on and on, as you can endlessly rationalize to yourself, the bottom line is it's fabricating. And so we want to be able to, for two reasons. I mean, the essential reason that mindfulness was cultivated as the basis of meditation centuries and centuries ago, because if one is not in the present, if one not can be present to what is before one, if one is not can be present to what is arising in the mind, then any attempt at any sort of change cannot occur. Or even if it occurs, it will occur with total inconsistency. Right, so it needs that capacity for mindfulness and some degree of concentration. As we also know in this day and age, when just people's everyday minds are so scattered, and people's everyday minds are so lost in dispersion, right? That even just ordinary life to people is so fantastically alienated from reality. Right. That therefore there has been a whole new use of mindfulness taught by people like Thich Nhat Hanh and now many others that just, just to be in the present, just to know you're washing the dishes, just to know you're walking, just to know you're in nature, just to know that you're looking at a tree, just to know that you're in the presence of another human being, right? We have to practice mindfulness. Is that clear? So what it's kind of taken on a secondary kind of mental health a function in modern day. But originally, it was in the meditative tradition. Is that clear? So so please, when we're not doing other types of practices, be practicing mindfulness. There are a couple of times during the day when we will be, when the schedule says outdoor walking meditation. I think it happened this morning. This is outdoor walking meditation is not walking around. Okay? So if you're out there having a nice walk around, well, that could have been pleasant, but that's not walking meditation. Is that clear? That's not the practice of mindfulness. When you're practicing mindfulness and you're walking, it is a practice. You know, you should walk out the door, maybe walk down the steps and stop and remind yourself what you're doing, for starters. Okay? And then you proceed. And your proceeding is not at your normal walk-a-day, looking around and walking around, but you should be walking with real awareness of your body, of your relationship of your body to the earth, the touching. And when you see and hear, as you do because your eyes aren't closed, you should be present to whatever you're seeing, hearing, smelling, feeling with your skin. Is that clear? And if thoughts are arising, as they will, you let them come and go. It's just like in sitting practice. Okay? So this is important. And in the eating, when we're eating, when you're in your room, when you're in the bathroom, when you're bathing, this is all times of practicing mindful awareness. You're present to what you're doing. It doesn't have to be like this. You don't have to bear down. It could be very relaxed. It can be enjoyable. But the enjoyment is coming from a direct experience rather than you're thinking about or fantasizing about whatever. Even to say to yourself, gee, I'm really enjoying the shower. I mean, what do you need to say that for? I mean, obviously you're already enjoying it. So the party already knows it. But it's like somehow we have to say to ourselves, I'm really enjoying the shower. I'm really enjoying this food. Delicious. Well, you already knew that. There's a part of you already knew. It's a sensory experience, right? So we don't have to always be adding on commentary, right? I mean, I notice these days, like when you get these DVDs to movies, they're like these extras, where it's called commentary or something, where you can be watching the movie and somebody's commenting on it while you're... I mean, you know, I won't go into that. Again, that could be interesting for other reasons, but you don't need that in your own mind, okay? I mean, that you don't have to have somebody commenting, namely you, commenting on your experience. You know, unless you're famous or something, I guess. Somebody wants to pay for your commentary on yourself. You know, for most of us, we're not that exalted that anybody is interested in our commentary on ourselves. Glad you're enjoying your shower, but you know, everybody understand. So it is important that that you make mindfulness kind of the basis of a retreat, and then everything else is added on and into that. So whatever practices we're doing, reflections we're doing, other types of practices, you've already established this capacity to be present to whatever you're doing. Okay? I mean, any questions about that? I mean, this is... So when you're on retreat, no matter where you are or what you're doing. Is that clear? Good. Now let me get something else clear. I mean, let's get things clear right there from the start. Yeah, we don't want any misunderstandings. I've sort of been at this now for probably 20 years or so, this Dharma teaching, and I think I've learned a lot, but I've learned some important things over those years that the people I've worked with have taught me. I think there were many things that were implicit in their teachings that I received from my teachers. I think there are many things that are implicit in the teachings, not said outwardly, explicitly. And I think in some way, you know, like most of us, one thinks that everybody is kind of, you know, seeing or doing things the way you did, right? So so it took me a while to realize it's not working that way, right? Because people seem to be, even though they're hearing the teachings and doing the practices year after year, many people don't really transform. They maybe have some incremental change, but they don't transform. And so I kind of began to notice that and wonder about why is that? What is it that implicitly I kind of understand, and I think my teachers understand, but obviously is not being transmitted clearly so other people can understand it, because the medicines are not taking effect the way they do. One of the things, as you've heard me talk a lot about, is aspiration and intention. And we'll be talking about that very soon in these teachings. But I think something else that is implicit in these teachings, but I want to make explicit, is that most of the people who practice Dharma are practicing Dharma to work on their issues. Right? Everybody know what we're talking about, right? One thing we have in America, people have, is what? We have a lot of what? We have a lot of issues, don't we? Everybody know what I'm talking about. Everybody know what their issues are, right? Everybody's got lots of issues, and everybody wants to get rid of their issues, right? And so we invest a lot of energy, conversation. We buy lots of books. We go into therapy, all kinds of things, because we want to what? Remediate, lessen our issues, right? But lo and behold, what happens? As one issue disappears, another issue appears. Anybody notice that? It's kind of layered, right? And one can find 5, 10, 15, 20 years has gone by, for some 25, 30, 35, 40, and one can look back and say, what? I've worked through a lot of issues in my life, and yet I don't feel liberated. I don't feel free. I don't really feel open and at ease. Right? My heart is not full of loving kindness, and, you know, it's still feels constricted, right? Still stuff going on. I'm still dealing with my hurts and my angers, you know, much less than I used to, right? But still the general context of my mind and my life has not significantly changed and may have gotten better. And there are many people in this room who would say, yeah, I've been practicing Dharma, short time, long time. My life is better, right? My relationships are better. And yet, when we're honest with ourselves, we see, still, I'm not free. I am still driven by my conditioning, my habit energy, my issues. Does everybody know what I'm talking about? Okay. So let me say quite explicitly what is implicit. The practice of Buddhism is not about working on issues. It's not about working on your afflictions. And there's one thing we love to do is what? Work on our afflictions. Right? Whether it's anger, whether it's anxiety, whether it's sadness, depression, jealousy, judgment. We love to take those things out and just work them. Right? Don't we? We love to work on them, kind of intensifying them. You know, we really, when we get up there with our obsession and our rumination, we really love to work on them. And then when we go, catch ourselves, then what do we do? we work on them. You know, what is the technique I'm supposed to be practicing to work on my anger? And what do you do, Tonglen now? And you did that. Or, you know, we reduce Dharma to a bunch of problems and techniques to solve problems. Right? Dharma as a bunch of techniques. Right? Like Dharma as a, you know, as a bag of medicines. Right? That you always, you know, which medicine do I take? And a lot of people, because they've taken lots of teachings or lots of, you know, they go all over the place taking teachings, they have bags full of, you know, I mean, all kinds of stuff. You know, which one do I do here? Which one? This one said to do this. Which one said to do that? Right? This is not the practice of Dharma. The Buddha taught one thing, the cessation of suffering. The cessation of suffering is nirvana. Nirvana is not the same as samsara. Nirvana is not the world of suffering, is not the world of duality. It is not the world of issues. Is that clear? I'm saying to try to explicitly as I can. Dharma is a different way of living, thinking, feeling, speaking, acting, different. It's a different context to life. It's a different mind. It's the same mind, but it's different than the mind, than the worldly mind. It feels differently. One sees differently. Right? Transformation. Transformation means, Leonard, the English teacher, transformation means?
It's changed, more than
changed. The form is changed. The form has changed. Right? It's changed into something else. Right? It's not just kind of rearranging the, what is it, rearranging the, on the decks of the Titanic, rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. That's what most of us are doing, right? We're rearranging the chair. Well, this is nicer, a little more space here. I got rid of that old chair that was broken down. I kind of redecorated a bit, you know, it's kind of... But we're still on the Titanic. For those of you who saw the movie, you know where it's heading. Even if you have the nicest stateroom on the Titanic, everybody from those in the nicest stateroom down to those in the steerage, heading toward the same place. Last year, we spent time. First, we had an intensive retreat on the afflictions. Everybody loves the afflictions. Identifying which affliction is theirs, and everybody likes to work on their afflictions. But then we went to what? Anybody remember? The seven factors of awakening. In which we were taught, Buddhism is about the cultivation of these factors of awakening. That's what Buddhism is about. Right? And the skillful handling, healing of these afflictions. But we need to understand that the cultivation of this has a direct effect on this. You don't always have to be working this. You cultivate this, it changes the context of your mind. Right? And it is cultivating a whole array of healthy behaviors and ways of thinking and ways of being that directly affect this significantly. Right? It's like somebody who has lots of physical problems, heart problems, joint problems, headaches, always running to the doctor, right? Keeping the pharmacy profitable, right? And then they learn what? Oh, by taking better care of myself, right? Losing weight, exercising, eating healthy foods, eliminating things that aren't good for me, exercising, meditating, you know, getting a good night's sleep, right? Just basic things. My body gets healthier, and lo and behold, what happens to a lot of those physical problems that one was having? Anybody here ever done that? Anybody ever here made a change in the way they were taking care of their body, what they were eating, how they were exercising, getting a good night's sleep, other kinds of things? Has anybody noticed that some of those physical problems that they had just went away? Molly's saying yes. You said what, right? You didn't have to keep, you know, working on the headaches. Right? You didn't have to still working on the lack of energy. All of a sudden, by developing a healthy body, a lot of these problems just went away. Right? Everybody know what we're talking about. If you don't, please ask me. Okay? So we know that. This is the same in your mind. When you put your primary energy into the cultivation of the seven factors of awakening, or as we learn in the mind trainings, these other wonderful things, that will have a significant effect on those parts of you that still suffer. You don't have to be putting all your energy and attention onto your afflictions. People don't not only have afflictions that arise, you know, they also think about them a lot. They also identify with them a lot. They love to talk to other people about them a lot. And you wonder why they continue year after year. Dharma is not about the cultivation of affliction. Dharma is about the cultivation of the factors of awakening. Dharma is not about, again, rearranging the chairs on the deck. Dharma is about what? Getting on a different boat that's not headed toward an iceberg. Is that clear? So again, it took me a long time to realize, this is what's going on. No wonder years go by and people still have these afflictions. And they're good people. They're well-meaning people. They're people who do, in many ways, practice Dharma, but they don't practice Dharma correctly. They don't practice Dharma the way the Buddhas and the Masters have taught us. We practice Dharma, we hear Dharma with our worldly ears. You know, it is said, going back to the earliest teachers, and you've heard me talk about it, you've probably read it, you know, students, Dharma students, right? Some Dharma students are like the upside-down bowl, right? Doesn't matter how much pure ambrosia you pour, it just all goes down, never gets in. Bowl's upside down. Some people just, they show up, but nothing sinks in, right? Other people are like what? They're like the bowl with the, you know, with all the holes in it. It's like a sieve. Dharma goes in, Dharma goes out. It doesn't, nothing sticks. But also, there are other people, the bowl is upright, and the bowl doesn't have any holes in it, but the bowl is dirty. The bowl is dirty with our own ideas, our own conceptualizations, our own egocentricity. And so even though the Dharma is being poured in, it gets contaminated. Right? And so when we drink it, it doesn't give us, you know, the nourishment that pure milk or even ambrosia. So it is said in the Dharma. When one receives the teachings, you know, one should always have a clean, upright bowl. So when the teachings or practices are poured in, they can go right in purely and they will work their magic. They will give us the nutrition, the nourishment we need for transformation. But if everything is filtering through our skewed perceptions, our own egocentric ideas of what we need and what we don't need, and, you know, there's a reason we don't change in a transformative way. And it's important that everybody, let's say for here, who's here, really get straight with themselves what they want to do, right? You know, I mean, really, is all I want to do is just kind of get a more comfortable deck chair. Right? So I want to have a little more space on the deck. Okay, or am I looking for a boat that's not heading for an iceberg? I mean, any questions about that? Don't, so again, it's the cultivation of a healthy mind as it's a healthy mind state, which is the most important thing Dharma practitioners, Dharma students should be doing. If your life and your mind is still focused on your issues, your problems, your conflicts, your afflictions, that's not the practice of Dharma. That's the practice of affliction. Right? You will be like the tar baby. No matter how, you know, how many times you try to free yourself, you'll wonder, why am I never free? Get away from the tar. Get out of the tar pit. So these teachings that we've come here to receive this weekend, for example, are about just what I'm talking about. You know, it doesn't get easier than this. Right? Here's the manual. Follow it, you'll come to enlightenment. Is that clear? It's as simple as that. Do it your way, you'll never get there. I mean, and again, it's your choice. If, you know, many people say, well, I really don't want to get there. That's fine. I mean, there's no problem with that. But then don't be frustrated or disappointed. Don't blame the teacher. Don't blame the teaching. Any questions about that? Yes, Maria.
So you say calculate the seven factors of awakening.
Well, I just use that as an example, yes.
And then afflictions by themselves will slowly.
Many of them, yes, will just slowly, just like, yeah, yeah. So again.
Cultivate mindfulness, concentration.
Well, I mean, the retreat's going to be on all that. So for now, just get that one, right? And we'll use this text during the course of these next 4 days to show us a way. Okay, you know, I'm not just going to leave you like, hey, well, what do you do? Okay, so don't worry. Yes.
So, friend, what you're saying is, don't treat the Dharma like some like super therapy practice.
It's not therapy. Again, therapy is about what? Anybody go to therapy? Anybody's a therapist? I mean, therapy is about what? You have problems, you go to the therapist, and the therapy is supposed to help you what?
Solve
your problems, fix your problems, you know? So you have a problem, you go to the therapist, gets better, you're done, right? Therapy is about fixing problems or getting rid of problems, right? Dharma is, you know, of course, there's a piece of Dharma that will do that. But Dharma is about the cessation of suffering. right? I mean, Brandy's a therapist. Is that what you have over your, is that how you advertise? Come see Brandy Kidd for the cessation of suffering? No, right? But that's what Dharma, that should be over the Dharma hall, you see? But you're just, you know, come to me with your very specific suffering, and I will help you with that, right? So that's, understand, so that's kind of the, and I mean, I was a therapist, so I'm not saying anything wrong with that, but that's what that is. And I think was like behind your question is that we come to Dharma like it's just a kind of a super therapy.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's much more beyond that. Again, we're going to get into that. But I just want to make explicit what is implicit in Buddhism from the Buddha on down the line. So, what are we up to these next 4 days? How many people are familiar with the mind slogans, just in general? Kind of read them, heard about them. How many people have never heard about them? Okay. How many people been on a retreat or something? In relationship to the mind trainings. Okay, so there's a decent number of people. Okay. So what we are, and I am using this source of these commentaries on the mind slogans by a 19th century great Tibetan master named Jamyang Kongtrul. He was one of the founders of what became known in Tibet, Eastern Tibet, as the Rime movement, sort of this non-denominational, non-sectarian movement. They kind of reform movement, we probably would call it, within Tibetan Buddhism, to after a time, I guess, where they felt things had degenerated, to find the essential teachings of Dharma, to get beyond sectarianism, to find these teachings and practices in all the four major sects, and to show their universality, and also to really make sure that they're not things that are just studied, but they're things that are practiced. It's a very powerful movement, and a great teacher, and Jamyang Kongtrul was one of them. So this is his commentary on it, and I know everybody in our current intensive are looking at this text. These mind trainings, or slogans as they are called, kind of have their historical unfolding with a great Indian master by the name of Atisha, A-T-I-S-H-A, who came from India to Tibet around 1,000 or something, you know, A.D. And he brought these teachings with him. And Atisha, who had been invited to come to Tibet, because at that time, again, Tibet had gone through a period of difficulty. There had been a king, Longdharma, who had really was sort of an anti-Buddhist as Buddhism had spread. He was sort of the old forces. He had become king. He was really on a very strong to eradicate Buddhism. So eventually reasserted itself. There had been a lot of conflict and things like that. So they wanted to bring somebody of great stature from the Indian Buddhist tradition to kind of restore the purity of the Dharma, feeling that during this period of chaos, things might have run astray a bit. So Atisha was asked to come to Tibet. And he was, again, a great master. But one of the things, and in many ways, he was a great master. But the Tibetans were really most interested in sort of certain very direct kind of core teachings, because they felt that that was really what had kind of got contaminated or died out. Atisha is supposed to have had 108 teachers, was fully versed in all aspects of Dharma, but especially he was versed in how many people know about Shantideva, the path of the Bodhisattva. I know we've studied that a lot, but again, that Bodhisattva tradition, going back to Shantideva. And he had several great teachers in that tradition. There are stories that some of his great teachers were great masters of compassion. I mean, they tell stories, I don't remember their names. Things like, again, they're meaningful stories. Don't take them totally literally, but maybe they were literal. Somebody needed a patch of skin to heal themselves, and they came, in the same way we could say maybe today people need an organ transplant or something, but he no one was willing to give up a patch of their skin, but he was. And supposedly his practice of non-self was not that great, and he actually went through a lot of suffering. But he did it because he understood that the teaching said, think of others ahead of oneself. And even though he didn't have the realization to make it effortless, he still did it. And then supposedly in the night he had a vision and a dream and he was healed and everything was quite wonderful. Another teacher was a famous teacher again of this path of compassion. Again, I think the story was there's a dog around, there's a teaching going on, and somebody throws a stone at the dog, right, hits it, and the teacher goes, "Ouch!" And of course, people think, kind of interesting. He must be a very sensitive guy. But afterwards, he showed them that he actually had the mark of the stone. Right? So it was not just he was just an empathic person. He actually was totally connected to that suffering of that animal, and the stone striking the door was no different than the stone striking him. So these were kind of stories that are told about some of his teachers. But these teachings related to the mind trainings, these slogans, supposedly could not be found in India. There were no masters of that lineage left. And he heard that there was this teacher in Indonesia, Sumatra. So he journeyed by boat from India to Sumatra to find these teachings. And again, remember, he had already had 107 teachers. He was quite well known. So understand his thirst for Dharma, how deep it was. And again, even at he wasn't a young man, he still undertook a very arduous journey to receive these teachings, and spent many years with Sir Lingpa, in which he received these pith slogan teachings. And then when he came to Tibet, he taught them, and they were maintained primarily as an oral tradition in what is called the Kadam tradition, which came from Atisha. And then eventually this Chikawa Yeshe Dorje heard about them. Supposedly he was in a teacher's room and happened to just see a phrase, give victory to others, take defeat upon oneself, and went, "Wow, what's that?" And so was quite intrigued. And he asked whoever room he was in, where'd that come from? He said, oh, it came from this teacher. And he went to that teacher and studied with him many years. And then eventually he was the one who wrote down these mind trainings, after which they continued on and really kind of entered most of the traditions of Tibet. And there are commentaries in really all the traditions, of which this is one, you know, that's been translated from the Tibetan. So again, these mind trainings are in the tradition of the practice tradition, in which these are called pith teachings. In other words, if anybody has read Buddhism, read sutras, read the Abhidhamma, one knows they're fairly dense and elaborate and complex. Right, and they're, you know, and so one has to kind of really apply one's intellect deeply to understand them, right? But in the practice lineage, having these teachings all boiled down, right, into very tiny statements, right, as these slogans are. Again, they're like, they're like the pit that has, you know, the capacity of the whole tree in it, if planted in soil. But I'm also thinking, what are those things, you know, your kid, you put them in water and they kind of just, oh, I don't know, they're like flowering things. What? You know, what?
Sea monkeys.
What do sea monkeys do? What do sea monkeys do? What?
I don't know.
Oh, I don't know either. Could be sea monkeys. I was thinking of the things, you know, where you put them in water and they just expand.
They're like compressed sponges.
Or compressed sponges. Yeah. But they're also kind of things like flowers, little things that come up and they put them in water and they... Anyhow. So, what? So anyhow, we won't go into that. But it's like that. Okay, they're very tiny, but when you add the right ingredients, they expand greatly. So let us begin. And obviously there are 50-something slogans. We're not going to do all of them. We'll probably just do a few of them during this retreat, but we will go deeply into them. So actually, Jamyang Kangchrol begins with a prayer. He says, with undivided faith, I place upon my head the lotus feet of the perfect sage. Perfect sage is the Buddha. So he kind of imagines the Buddha, who first set in motion the wheel of love and triumphed completely in the two aims. The two aims is the liberation of self. He totally liberated himself as well as he worked ceaselessly. His second aim was not only his own liberation, his second aim was to benefit all beings. Triumph completely in the two aims. To the renowned sons of the victorious ones I bow, Manjusri, Avalokiteshvara, the others, who set out in the ship of courageous compassion and now liberate beings from the ocean of suffering. So everybody here in this room is setting out in this Dharma path, right? How many people can say to yourself, I have set out on the path, on the ship? Right? You see the words here? He says set out. So that's us. I've set out on the ship of courageous compassion. Right from the beginning. And now liberate beings from the ocean of suffering. So right from the earliest stages of one's practice, one can take compassion, the concern for others' suffering and the desire to be of benefit, right, as the ship one is traveling. The spiritual friend unsurpassable, those are the teachers, so the living teachers, reveal the noble path of compassion and emptiness. They are the guides of all victorious ones. I prostrate myself at my teacher's feet. I shall explain here the one path of which the victorious one and his children have traveled. Listen, please. Easy to understand, it is not corrupted. Easy to practice, it is entered with enthusiasm. Yet it is profound, so Buddhahood is attained. Easy to understand. It is not corrupted. It is not contaminated. It is simple and direct. Easy to practice. Just follow the instructions. But it needs to be entered with enthusiasm. Another one of those conditions that is implicit. Here it's being made explicit. Entered with enthusiasm, energy, interest, curiosity. If there's no enthusiasm for what we're doing, there won't be much result, will there? Yet it is profound. Even though it is easy to understand, easy to practice, yet it is profound. Right? It has the depth of the path to transformation, so Buddhahood is attained. So that is his opening prayer. And then he goes into the source of the transmission, beginning from it with the teacher, his teachers, and going all the way down to the present time. Then the next chapter is called The Need for Mind Training. So please remember that, you see, he doesn't just jump right in, does he? Even though he's going to be commenting on these trainings, explaining how to practice them, he gives a setting. See, already he's showing us how to practice. We need to have some understanding of what we're getting into. We have to understand the rich source from which these teachings come. They're not just made up. It's not Shambhala. It's not Shambhala, the publishers. Do you understand that? This is a Tisha. This is Shantideva. These are all their teachers. This is Sirlingpa. This is Chikawa. This is this whole tradition. That's what this is. Right? That is why we should never leave Dharma books on the floor or treat them like we treat books. That's who this is. Right? This is how they still live. And if we don't understand that and deeply appreciate that, there will be no enthusiasm. If we just treat it like another book, bedside reading table, with some work of fiction or something else on top of it, or some magazine. Where's that? I'm supposed to be working on my my intensive. Where's that book? You gotta go to, it's under the Tampa Bay Times somewhere. What does that tell us about our understanding of the preciousness of these? If we don't treat them as precious, we will not take them in the way they're meant to be taken. A Dharma book is the Buddha. It is the Dharma. It is the Sangha. It has the power to liberate us. If liberation is really something significant in our life, then everything connected with this, we need to have at least an inherent respect and appreciation. So now he says the need for mind training, right? Again, can you see the logical progression? First he invokes the teachers, lets us know this precious lineage, who they are, how this is, has a possibility of transformation, profound, simple, applicable. And then he goes, now, do you know why you need it? Right? You see, we have to reflect in this way because we'll forget. Right? We're too busy doing what? Running errands. Right? We're too busy, taking care of business. Right? We forget about our need for mind training. And then we wonder at the end of the day, why haven't I practiced today? Because you really don't see a need for it. You know, we think our to-do list is more important. Got to get to Home Depot before it closes. Right? What is it I'm supposed to pick up? You know? Right? That's where our minds are. Right, Bill? Yeah. And we wonder why. So again, these poor teachers, they kind of, all right, if this was not enough, let me, okay. We teach our teachers patience and understanding. So he begins, don't even consider the ephemeral happiness that results from birth in the higher realms of gods and men. Right? So he's right from the beginning. He says, you know, don't give a heed to kind of, you know, the ephemeral kind of happiness that comes from having a good life. He said, don't even consider it. And even though the Shravakas and the Pratika Buddhas can have their own kind of enlightenment, it is not the final nirvana or the transcendence of misery. Consequently, we should strive only for the state of completely perfected Buddhahood. Okay. No teaching has been given at all yet. And right away he's telling us, aim for the highest. Cessation of suffering, Buddhahood. Don't be satisfied with lower aims in your life. He said, there are no methods to effect this attainment other than those which rely on the two forms of meditation, relative bodhicitta, which is training the mind of love and compassion, and ultimate bodhicitta, which is resting evenly in the non-discursive state, free from conceptual elaborations. And we will be getting into that. But he says very simply and clearly, this is the path. Right? At the relative level, it's a path of compassion and love. And at the wisdom level, the unconditioned level, it is really understanding the nature of mind and resting there. And he quotes Nagarjuna, the great Indian teacher of the Madhyamika, the Mahayana, Nagarjuna, great teacher of Prajnaparamita. He says, if the rest of humanity and I wish to attain unsurpassable awakening, the basis for this is bodhicitta, as stable as the king of mountains. Compassion, which touches everything, and pristine wisdom, which does not rely on duality, etc., etc. So for these and many other reasons, we must meditate energetically on relative bodhicitta at the beginning if we are to achieve any meaningful results with respect to bodhicitta. For someone who wishes instruction on the subject, the basic method for training is, as Shantideva says, quote, he or she who desires shelter quickly for himself and all others should use this sacred mystery, the exchanging of oneself for others. And we know that a key in this text is this profound practice of exchanging self and other. And again, for those who are familiar with Shantideva and the way of the Bodhisattva, we know that he really goes into it in that text too. So now, we are at the actual instructions, of which, again, there are seven major points. I'll read them for those who aren't familiar. First is the preliminaries, which teach the support for Dharma. Two, the actual practice, training in bodhicitta. Three, the transformation of adverse conditions into the path of awakening. Four, the utilization of one's practice in one's whole life. Five, the extent of proficiency in mind training. Six, commitments of mind training. Seven, guidelines for mind training. So there are, and those who are familiar with them, they really cover the whole range of human experience, and really all the teachings of the Mahayana are found in them, right? Okay. And we will, work on the beginnings. In this retreat, hopefully, we'll have time to begin with the preliminaries, look at actual unconditioned absolute bodhicitta tomorrow and relative the next day. And then maybe we can slip in a few other the wonderful slogans like drive all blame into one, always have the support of a joyous mind, be grateful to everyone. I hope when you woke up this morning, the first thought after you realized where you were was gratitude. Fresh sheets. I had my windows open. Nice breeze. How fortunate. Most people in the world don't wake up to this, do they? How fortunate. I didn't have to go slogging out to the outhouse. Right? Just walked into the bathroom. Pushed this thing down and just was taken away. Went over to the sink, fresh, clean water, right there. Don't have to worry about contamination. Wash the face. Right? Tom's toothpaste. Natural toothpaste. I mean, right, right? I mean, how wonderful, right? Come downstairs. I drink tea. I mean, somebody made hot water, you know? What a wonderful universe. We should have nothing but gratitude. If you didn't, I'd ask you, where was your mind? What were you thinking about? What were you looking at? Be grateful to everyone, to everything. Always have the support of a joyous mind, grateful mind. It doesn't just happen by itself. It has to be cultivated. It's a game changer. When you think that way, all the ways you might have thought this morning, oh no, I'm tired, no, I gotta get up, I don't want to meditate, blah, blah, blah. Right? Wouldn't even be there, wouldn't have any room. Right? But if you don't cultivate in this way and leave, empty space, that empty space will immediately fill up with what? All our egocentric nonsense. Complaining, whining, right? And people say, I'm sick of it, but yet all they do is cultivate it. Drive all blames into one. So, the first point is the preliminary, which teach the support for Dharma. So again, this is important because before he gives any meditative teaching at all, he will not even begin, right, until practice has support. Is that clear? And again, many of us have begun to practice Dharma for years and have never given the practice the support it needs. Right? I assure you, as we look into these preliminaries, and I would imagine most of you are familiar with them, I mean, in our community, we sort of have gone at them in many ways over the years, but if you really get them, I'm about to say 100% of your suffering would have gone, maybe say 90% or something, 80%. We pay lip service to them, but we don't get them and live them. So again, there are two preliminaries. So the first is the preliminary to appear to meditation, and the other is preliminary instruction sort of to one's whole life. So this again is important to understand that the idea of preliminaries, the idea of setting, getting the setting right, getting the support right, is even in our daily meditation. Many of us just sit down, right? Or many of us just walk outside without really stopping and creating a structure, a support for our practice. Again, practice means we're consciously doing something, right? That's practice. And so if we're not approaching what we're doing in the correct way, we won't have the right kind of enthusiasm, we won't have the right kind of interest, right? We won't have the right kind of diligence. So it's a lot of these preliminaries that are essential. That is why they're gone into first, right? Because in understanding, if we jump right in without them, then again, it'll be half-hearted, it'll be on, it'll be off, we'll be easily dissuaded or distracted. Okay? Now, and again, this is in the Tibetan/Indian tradition of what became known as Vajrayana Buddhism, in which they begin by invoking their root teacher above their head. Again, we don't teach that in our community, that approach. I certainly have practiced that when I practice in the Tibetan tradition. And there's, some people have it's interesting. I think I was telling somebody when I did this intensive on the trainings back in 2008, when I got to this section and was teaching, I told people, oh, well, this, you know, you can kind of ignore this. This is what they do in the, we don't do that here. Well, it's interesting. This time I forgot to say that on the initial Dharma talk, right? And the interesting thing, as I've been, I do calls with everybody. I've listened to calls this week, and lo and behold, people are saying to me, wow, that's really great. You know, I've never done that before. That was really helpful to me. That really changed the quality of my meditation. So I stand corrected. I was a little too hesitant. Again, it's the setting, right? And traditionally, in the practice tradition, okay, we're not just talking about somebody who goes to Buddhist temples or somebody who kind of takes Buddhism as an ethical teaching or a devotional teaching, but especially someone who is walking the path, for healing and transformation. It is good to have models of that and to feel connected to that lineage, right, of awakened people, of people who have transformed themselves, right, to feel connected to that. It is our living teachers that have given us that connection, right? Therefore, to visualize, have a visualization of this lineage going through your teacher, through his teachers, back to the Buddha, kind of all encapsulated in this one image, and feeling their presence, right? And feeling their presence, again, gives a context in which we are undertaking whatever practice we're doing. Is that clear? It's just a way. There are other ways, but it's creating this bigger context, because many of us, we feel, kind of alone, right? And oftentimes when we're alone on our cushion, we've often brought our kind of neurotic mind, right, to the cushion with us. And so we want to change the context. And so one of these ways is what is done here, where you visualize the root teacher, the lineage. And then with great respect, you say, I pray for your blessing, my teacher, guru is here, but teacher, great and completely worthy spiritual friend. I pray that you will cause love, compassion, and bodhicitta to arise in my mind. So not only do you feel a connection, but you feel, you say the words. Oh, many people think, this is another thing that I want to make explicit. Right. Buddhist practice is not about counting your breath. I can't believe how many people come to me like upset because they can't get to 21. You know, like that's what this is about. First grade was about counting. Is that clear? This is about transformation. This is about healing. This is about the awakening of the mind. Please do not reduce it to counting. Counting is just one of the things we do to do, you know, to learn how to concentrate our mind. But the transformation is on the mind, not the counting. Right? It's like people come and go, oh, you know, I'm just driven my thoughts. I wish I could do something about my thoughts. Your thoughts aren't the problem. It's the you that's, you know, looking at the thoughts. You're the problem. Right? Your thoughts are just thoughts. They come and go. Right? But that which is aware of the coming and going, that's what people say, oh, it's, you know, my mind's agitated. No, your mind's not agitated. You're agitated. Your mind is just doing what it does. You can be at peace, even if you have lots of thoughts. It's we're transforming the mind, that which is aware of the thoughts. That's the mind we're transforming. Right? I mean, many people actually believe they'll know that their practice is working for them when they can get to 21. Right? Then I can get the star, right, Charner? Teacher will put a star on my thing. I can take it home to mommy and daddy. It's not about that. Again, it's good to learn how to count. I'm not saying it's not about to learn, but it's not. It's about the person we're becoming. And then you imagine that you come down through the top of your head and just fills your whole being. So again, I guess what I'm saying is when you sit down to meditate, you know, do some preliminaries. Okay? Connect with your tradition. Take refuge. We're going to go into four contemplations in a moment. Remind yourself. Bodhicitta, I undertake this practice so as to benefit all beings. Oh, that's what I'm doing this for. Remind yourself of the benefits of meditation. Calming your mind, quieting your mind, opening your heart. Oh, that's what I'm doing. Right? And we're not counting 1 to 21. You see how we reduce this wonderful Dharma transformative practice to a series of techniques and exercises? That we fail and pass at. That's our dirty mind. We take this wonderful Dharma and we just contaminate it with our own screwed up notions. Did anybody ever read that the purpose of Buddha Dharma is to learn how to count? No. The purpose of Buddha Dharma is what? What? What are you saying back there? What?
Ending suffering.
Transformation. Awakening the mind. Right? Compassion. Understanding the nature of things. Wisdom. Right? Paramitas. Generosity. Patience. That's what Buddhism is about. It's not about, you know, these are me. These are things that we do along the way, but that's not the goal. Right? Don't reduce Dharma to a series of little exercises. Oh, wow. Hopefully in the guided meditations today, these will go more in depth. But basically, let me just say, and you've heard me say it before, those of you who've been around, these four preliminary contemplations are key. You get these, your life and your Dharma practice will just flow. They are worth spending time on. Many people, they read them, oh, I get it, and they move on to the next page. I'm going to get on to chapter 2, right? There's a reason they put this first. Okay, please understand the wisdom of our teachers. There's a reason they put it first. Again, that's our own false thinking that we know better. We don't stop and go, why did they put this first? Right? Why do they say these are the preliminaries of practice? These are the things you do before you do that. Is that clear? I mean, please slow it down and get what's being taught us. So these four preliminaries are basically about this relative world. Okay? It teaches us, you know, in all that's going on, internally and externally, in my own life, in lives in the whole world, you know, are there any central principles? You know, is there any way that I can view this chaos, right, of unfoldings, you know, in some kind of meaningful way? You know, it's sort of like, what's going on here? Is that clear? You know, and what this is about is called the view. We want to have, you know, an enlightened view of what's going on. The lights are turned on, enlightened. I can see clearly what's going on. And luckily, we don't have to, we don't have to do all the work to discover it ourselves. From the Buddha on, they have discovered it, and now they're kind of spoon-feeding it to us, you know, so we can discover it for ourselves, but they've already digested it. Is that clear? I mean, that's where he says, it's so easy, right? It's already been pre-digested. Right? It doesn't get any easier than this. But we have to what? We have to eat it ourselves. So it gets into our bodies. So, impermanence. Anybody ever hear about impermanence? Yeah. Oh, we all know about impermanence. If you knew about impermanence, I mean, why do you suffer? Why do you suffer in the face of change? Change within your own bodies, change within the bodies of others, change within your own mind, change within your mind of others, change within the world, you know, change within peoples, you know. In this world of impermanence, impermanence of body, permanence of mind, nothing stable at all, right? Atoms, just moving around in there, right? Endless worlds. Science looks out there, and what do they see? There's no end to it. As far as they look, more, more, more. Suns coming into being, dying. World systems coming into being, dying. Planets coming into being, dying. Right? Meteors crashing into things. Sickness, old age, and death happening to everyone. Every body is subject to impermanence. Everything. Animals, minerals. Even minerals that seem so hard are wearing away. Right? Is that clear? This is just a fact. You know, in the old days, I don't know if they still do it, you know, at some point somebody explained the facts of life to you. Do you remember that? I mean, do you remember what they called the facts of life? It wasn't impermanence, was it? Right? I mean, that's how narrow our view is. My son or daughter, I want to explain the facts of life to you. and they take this little piece of life, and they call that the facts of life. Okay. These are the real facts of life. Impermanence. I mean, this morning we recited the five reflections, right? There they are. And yet, we're always thrown by it, disturbed by it, saddened by it, angered by it, scared by it. Within ourselves, our own bodies, our own mind, everybody else's. And yet, you know, it's a fact of life this, that the Buddha noticed 2,600 years ago. So again, hopefully later in the day, these will be worked on. So impermanence needs to be reflected on until you get it. How do you know you get it? The endless changes, internal, external, physical, mental, will no longer throw you. You will have equanimity in this world of impermanence. Is that clear? Then you'll know you get it. Number two, cause and effect, karma. Everybody's heard of it. Everybody goes, yeah, I get it, right? Again, what does that mean? That means in this impermanent, ever-changing, insubstantial world, there is a law operating, right? Everything is operating according to the law of cause and effect. Something doesn't come out of nothing. Effects don't just happen by themselves. Causes and conditions, right, have a causal relation with everything, right? Is that clear? You know, Gary's all bent out of shape around what's going on the earth, aren't you, Gary? You know, that's good. But why do we have global warming? Causes and conditions. Simple as that. Right? The world cannot be other than it is now because of causes and conditions. We can argue about causes and conditions, right? But we understand it is unfolding because of causes and conditions. Okay? Is that clear? You know, why am I the way I am? Why do I have the mind I have? Why do I have the feelings I have? Why do I have the thoughts I have? Why do I have the kind of relationships I have? Because of what? Causes and conditions. Right? Everything is causes and conditions. To understand that is to move into a deep place of acceptance, impermanence, combined with the understanding of cause and effect. But also, most essentially, as practitioners, we know for ourselves that all that has conditioned my mind, all that has conditioned my speech, all that has conditioned the actions of my body, are the product of past causes and conditions. But if in the present I begin to make new, different causes and conditions, my life will change. The effects will be different in the future. That's where liberation comes in. Oh, it doesn't matter, you know, what's happened up to now, right? I can understand that's all causes and conditions, but from this moment on, because again, everything's impermanent, nothing's solid. I understand, oh. So the more, see again, this comes back to the first thing I talked about, right? Which is, you know, it's about new causes. As long as you're just working with the old stuff, all you're going to get is kind of a reformulation of the old stuff, right? But you want to make new causes. New causes will create new effects. The way you think, the way you perceive, the way you feel, your emotions, right? The way you speak, the way you act. All of that is subject to transformation. When it's totally transformed, it becomes what? A Buddha. Right? A Buddha who somebody early on understood about impermanence and cause and effect. Is that clear? And worked it. Right? If we don't work it, we will continue to, you know, continue to reify and continue on the causes and conditions that have brought us to this moment. If that's all we're doing, it will continue. There's no end. If you wonder why it's continued all these years, it's because we've continued it. Because we're not making new causes to create new effects. Is that clear? So this is profoundly important. Now the third one is the inherent unsatisfactoriness of worldly life. Samsara. The world of birth and death. Right? This relative world that we all live in. Okay? Again, I think this is a hard one for many of us because there is something in our culture that kind of gives us this false optimism and this sense of entitlement. We think what? What do we think about this world, if we're honest? We think it's a source of what? Happiness, stability. I can find happiness here. I can find meaning here in worldly activities, in things, in status, in relationships, in jobs, in wealth, in sensual pleasure, you know, right? We believe, right, by electing a new president, right, getting some legislation passed, we believe that what? We can create nirvana here. Nirvana is what? The absence of suffering. But this teaching says no. So this one's really got to work at. It'll never work. You'll fall in love, you'll make great commitments, but inherent in that you will find suffering. You'll have children, source of happiness, but you'll find, lo and behold, within that there is suffering. Right? You'll get the job, you'll get the relationship, you'll get the thing. Lo and behold, there will be dissatisfaction. There will be boredom. Right? Can you see? Doesn't matter where you go. Because this world is a world of what? Of change, of instability. It doesn't mean you can't find temporary happinesses, lots of them. Right? But they're inherently unsatisfactory because why? They're inherently meaningless. Why? Because they don't last, and they often become their opposite. Right. You get a body, great to have a body, then it gets sick, then it gets old. There it is. Right? Get yourself your brand new car, and then it's got a dent in it. Suffering. Right? Do I need to go on? I mean, this is just the way it is. So again, this is not a pessimistic, oh, the world's just an ocean of suffering. It's really saying there is no permanent satisfaction or meaning in any of it. All our activities, all our accumulations, no matter how beautiful our home is, how many beautiful things we have, how much status and money we have, all of it is meaningless. Why? Because of death. You know, because of death. It's like, you know, all of a sudden, at one point, it's all going to end. And all the things we've accumulated, and our beautiful body, and all our beautiful things, our ugly things, gone. And yet I've devoted my whole life to them. Okay. So this unsatisfactoriness of samsaric life, this confusion we have, we think samsara is nirvana. Right? If we just get the right guy and right, then the world, everything will be wonderful. But what's going to happen, Gary? It's not going to be like that, is there? No. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean things can't change. You don't get better. But, you know, like, you know, We have wars to end all wars. Do you remember that one? What happened to that one? You know, I mean, we couldn't even keep it going for a couple of decades, couldn't we? Right? Do you remember the Berlin Wall came down and we said what? It's over. Cold War is over. Right? And then we, you know, all of a sudden we had new wars. I mean, we, you know, which are, you know, it doesn't end. Now, why is that? Okay, is that clear? Mm-hmm. And the fourth one, and we'll end with that one, is the precious human birth. Okay. So in this world that we are born into, of impermanence, of cause and effect, of the inherent unsatisfactoriness of worldly pursuits, the meaninglessness of them, essentially. The fourth meditation reflection is on, so what do I do with this body? Right? You see, that's the question. All right. So if all this is true, right, if all the three others are true, then, you know, do I just what? Give into despair? Right? Right? Get depressed? Do I just abandon myself to hedonism? You know, get as much as I can, grab as much pleasure as I can? Right? You know, what do I do with this life? Is that clear? Can you see how that question naturally arises when one contemplates either others? And then we get this wonderful teaching. This is a precious life we have. First of all, you know, and again in the contemplations, it has the opportunities and the freedoms. It's very well delineated. But it really means, in a simple way, how fortunate I am to be born a human being. No matter whatever the storyline of my life, right? My childhood, good or bad, et cetera, et cetera. How my relationships have turned out or haven't, or my finances, or my this or that. This is a precious human life. One, because human beings, as opposed to animals and other forms of life, have self-awareness, right? We have the capacity of looking at our situation and drawing conclusions. Something that squirrels don't have, something that hyenas don't have. Is that clear? This is a marvelous thing, this mind of ours, right? Not only is it aware, but it has this capacity to kind of step back from our situation and to look at it, to draw conclusions, and to change course, right? So this to be born a human being with this human mind is extraordinary, right? Rocks don't have this. Plants don't have this. Animals don't have this. Maybe some of them do, but just traditionally, most animals don't have this capacity. So just to be born a human being and to have this human mind is a precious thing. But everything's impermanent. Everything is changing. Only don't know how long I'll have it. So let me look at my life. Right now, I have a fair degree of health. My mind is not too clouded by emotional afflictions, or I don't have any major kind of cognitive deficit or psychiatric problem. I mean, I can, you know, somehow think straight, you know what I'm saying? And my body, my mind. I have leisure, right? I mean, look at us. Here we are. we're all here. We can take off 4 or 5 days to devote to Dharma. You know, I'm not born in a situation of extreme deprivation or extreme poverty or extreme extremity of war. You know, where, I mean, in Syria, I don't think they're getting together for 5-day retreats, are they? In other places of the world, how fortunate. So one thinks like that, you know. I have really a certain degree of freedom and leisure that most people in the world don't have. I am born in a time where the Dharma is alive, right? There are many places in this world where there's no Dharma, right? There's life, there's difficulty, challenges, but there's nobody teaching Dharma. There's nobody teaching another way in life, right? A way to end suffering, to awaken. How fortunate I am. I'm born, I'm born at a time where the Dharma is in the world. The teachers are still in the world teaching the Dharma. I have a teacher. I have teachers. How fortunate I am, right? I have opportunity to practice. I have health. Right? So all this together is called the precious human birth. Right? And this body, temporary, this mind, temporary, there is something meaningful that I can do with it. Right? It does have a purpose. I can find meaning in the meaninglessness. I can find something meaningful and solid in this world of such transitoriness. Oh, awakening, freedom, liberation. That's what this life's about. That's the most essential thing that I can do with this body mind of mine. And all these other things that I have been doing, all these toxic things and unhealthy things or meaningless things, or all this energy that I put into all these pursuits, as I look back over my life, what have they produced? What have they produced? If you don't think like this, reflect like this, we'll continue to waste our time here. Because this precious life that we may say I have today, we might not have tomorrow. We might not have next year. That is the truth. So this fourth contemplation is wonderful. It kind of redeems the other three, can you see? The other three kind of go, whoa. You know, maybe I'll just curl up with a good book and Netflix. And oh no, there's something wonderfully wonderful that I can do with this life. And not only can I do it for myself, but I can do it for others. Because everybody I know, all my loved ones, family, friends, colleagues, they're all in the same boat, aren't they? So good, we will stop here. And we will please, use today to reflect deeply on what has been shared this morning, the preliminaries, and contemplate in a very personal way impermanence, cause and effect, unsatisfactoriness of worldly pursuits, and my precious human birth. And see if it really rings true for you, whether you really get it. And you'll get it because you'll find a natural turning toward meaning, toward purpose, toward the meaningful, toward that which can really produce a consistent state of well-being and happiness and ease and open-heartedness that is not predicated on externalities, on the worldly wind, so to speak. Good, so we will stop here.